Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 12th of January. An article in Sunday's Sunday Review section in the New York Times titled, It's Payback Time for Women, Society is Getting a Free Ride on Our Perpetuation of the Human Race, caught our attention. And it is just a fascinating story. And let me read part of it. The person who wrote the article is our guest this hour. She says, a country that gives every citizen enough cash to live on, whether she needs it or not. It's got to be either a fool's paradise or a profligate Northern European nation. In November, the Finnish government proposed paying every adult 800 euros, or about $870 a month. And now the Swiss will vote in a referendum on basic income this year. The Dutch city of Utrecht will soon start a basic income pilot program. And Canada's ruling Liberal Party recently adopted a resolution calling for a similar experiment. And she asked the question, could it happen here? It's a very, very interesting idea. And our guest is Judy Shulevitz. She is author of The Sabbath World, Glimpses of a Different Order of Time. She's a contributing opinion writer for the New York Times, and she is a writer who has contributed to all kinds of publications. She was a columnist and senior editor at the New Republic. She's worked with, contributed to the New Yorker, the Atlantic Monthly, and many other publications. And I'm very interested, as we carry on this conversation, for your thoughts about this. What do you think about it? And it's been proposed before by Thomas Paine, actually, years and years ago. Should a country give every citizen enough cash to live on, whether he or she needs it? How would it change everything? How would we afford this? And why is this an idea whose time seems to have come in certain countries? Why now? Our phone number for you to join this conversation is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, @KDunnShow. Hello, Judith. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Thank you for having me.
I love you. I just love this article because it really requires some very deep thought about so many issues. And I'm so glad you wrote it and it was displayed so prominently.
That was very nice, yeah.
Yeah, it was very nice. So the idea is a universal basic income. Why don't you describe what it is and who is considering it or has actually put it into effect in some countries?
A universal basic income means that every citizen gets some sort of stipend. that means it's not means tested. Our current welfare programs require you to fall below a certain level in order to qualify, and there's other, you know, qualifications placed on this money. The universal basic income just says everybody gets it. And what it is depends on, you know, what the nation can afford, what the sort of contract is between citizens and their government, that sort of thing,
mm-hmm.
What the feelings are towards redistribution of wealth, et cetera.
And it already is in effect in certain countries, in Alaska, in a different kind
of
way.
In Alaska, mm-hmm. in a sort of accidental, backhanded way. At a certain point, they decided to nationalize, as it were, their estate, but certain public resources, and to take the money that is earned by leasing these resources to oil and natural gas companies, invest it in a fund, and pay out a certain amount to every single citizen, man, woman, or child, from that fund every year. So it varies depending on, you know, how the investments do, but it's around $2,000 a year, or, you know, $8,000 for a family of four.
Now, the money would go to everybody, but you talk about how this could be very appealing to women who vote in great numbers. Why would women find this appealing?
Well, I make the argument, I should say that most people who talk about basic income do not talk about it from a feminist perspective, but there are a number of really interesting feminist economists and scholars who are talking about it and have been for the last 20 years or so, but kind of under the radar. So the feminist argument is that women have, women do a second shift, or they do a full-time shift for which they are not paid. Obviously, the world is changing. It isn't just women anymore, but still it is predominantly women who take on this extra labor. And it is really the source of gender inequality in the workplace and economic inequality and other forms of social inequality, this extra unpaid work that women do. So this is a way to sort of get money to everyone, whether they're in the labor market or not, and to sort of level out the playing field between men and women.
And women are an important part of the whole human race because, as you remind us, one of the things they do is perpetuate the human race.
Right. So there's this view, I think, that that's out there in the world that stay-at-home moms are free riders. They live off their husbands, or they live off businesses that pay paid maternity leaves, or they sort of, you know, don't contribute. If they take unpaid maternity leaves, they're not full contributors to the project that a company has or whatever it is, to the workforce. So there's this sense in which and this makes women feel secondary, lesser, their contributions are lesser, et cetera. I argue it should be looked at the other way, that society free rides on women's unpaid labor, essentially extracts this labor and turns it into value called the next generation of workers, you know, or just the next generation.
You also write that mainstream feminism really hasn't paid a whole lot of attention to this issue, that they're looking more at issues like family leave, not having family leave, care, weak infrastructure. Why is it that feminists have not been calling for this, that this isn't prominent in their list of what needs to be done?
So the second wave feminist movement was really focused on getting women out of the home and into the workforce, because that was not a choice they had, right, at the time. So they were saying, we don't want to be trapped in our homes. We want to be able to support ourselves. An incredibly noble and laudable goal. I mean, I am a career woman. You are a career woman. We wouldn't want to go back to the days where we had no options. Mm-hmm. However, what got lost in all this is solving for the problem of care, figuring out who's going to raise the children. If women are all out at work, how do we raise the children? One solution is subsidized daycare. We don't have that in this country anyway. And not all women want to be in the workforce all the time. They may want to leave the workforce and then come back into the workforce so that they can spend time with their children when they're little, for example. So I feel as though, you know, sort of mainstream, what I call Sheryl Sandberg feminism, deals only with women in the workforce and doesn't answer the question of, well, how are we going to deal with this problem of taking care of the children and our own desire to take care of the children ourselves?
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that's a big oversight, and that's one of the things that needs to be corrected, and one of the things universal basic income corrects. It's an indirect correction. I make some arguments about why we need the indirect correction rather than the direct correction.
Well, it's amazing. We did this show, and I think the story came from the New York Times, how many women go back to work. Oh, it was ProPublica, I think, and the New York Times, after 2 weeks after having given birth. There are times when you are a new parent where it makes perfect sense, and it's good for you, your health and the child's health, and for society, for you to be able to be somewhat flexible with your work life and take off those chunks of time when it is most beneficial to your family.
Right. I mean, so, yeah, I mean, as you well know, the United States has some of the most backward policies on maternity leave in the world, and certainly the worst policy in the developed world. But even that isn't what I'm talking about. And of course, in these, you know, liberal northern European countries, many of them provide up to a year of paid maternity leave. They offer paternity leave, and so on and so forth. That's a terrible situation, that we simply, you know, we just overlook a lot of working women and their need to stay home with their infants, which every, you know, study shows is good for the infant, is good for, you know, their development for the rest of their lives.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm saying, you know, women and men should be able to make the choice to simply stay home and take care of their children and get respect and remuneration for it. So I'm taking it a step further and saying this is valuable work and it won't be valued until we pay for it.
Right. But if it's going to mostly help women, because they are doing most of the heavy lifting and probably will until males' roles change pretty substantially, why not just make this a benefit that is for women? Why should it go to fathers as well as mothers, to virtually everybody?
Well, I mean, one of the things that's appealing about a universal basic income is that is not tied to sex, right? It's not just to women. It's not just to men. It's whoever's giving care. And, you know, that's going to become more important as more men do give care, and it will be a self-reinforcing mechanism, because if it's less devalued, if it is remunerated, more men will be willing to take it on. That sort of begs the question of why not just give it to caregivers. So the deeper philosophical argument for why not just give it to caregivers is that we all do the work of care at some point in our lives. We take care of older parents. We volunteer in our society. We take care of the homeless. There's a lot of caretaking that goes on, and in a way, a universal basic income, which isn't going to be really enough to live on under any circumstances, just says, here's the money for the work of care that you do that helps build a thriving civil society.
Mm-hmm. You also write in the article, this is really astounding, the number of jobs that are going to be lost in the next 20 or 30 years due to computers. We could see a real decrease in the workforce, couldn't we?
Yes, we could. I mean, look, this is a debated point, and I don't want to say it's absolutely going to happen. There's a very strong study that came out a couple years ago from Oxford University that, yes, said, computers could replace humans in nearly half of all occupations in the United States. Now, that's not half of all jobs. That's half of all occupations. But still, why is that? Because smart machines can now do not just sort of routine, you know, standardized work, but they can do non-routine, cognitively complex work. So they can take over, for example, management, right? A machine could manage people who are, you know, fast food workers at McDonald's, because there's a combination of surveillance and various kinds of input. They could figure out whether they're producing the way they should. So there's all kinds of positions that could be turned over to machines. One of the people I talked to said, he's a big basic income advocate, and he said, you know, his aha moment was when he was visiting a mine in Australia, and he saw self-driving trucks and mines being, you know, mined by, you know, worked by machines, and hardly a human in the place. And he said, my God, this is the future of work, and we've got to figure out a way to get money, to get the wealth that's going to be generated by computers to the people.
So you write that the Finnish government proposed paying every adult about $870 a month. Mm-hmm. Does that seem about right to you? It seems like a lot of money to pay everybody that kind of money, right?
Well, it's actually less than a lot of people are saying you really need, which is about $1,000 a month. It doesn't seem that generous to me. It seems like it would keep you out of poverty, like real serious poverty.
Mm-hmm. And the idea seems to be more talked about now, perhaps you suggest, because of the huge income gap in this country?
Yeah. I mean, I think that as we see the richer getting richer, the rich getting richer, and the poor and the middle class sinking lower, we're beginning to think about ways to get some of that money out of the hands of the rich and into the hands of the poor and the middle class. And this is one way to do it. It's to say that it's being talked about now is true, but I wouldn't want to say it hasn't gone through periods of being talked about a lot. So in the 60s, we almost had something like a basic income program. It's called a negative income tax, and the idea is if you fall below a certain income level, instead of paying taxes, the IRS pays you. And so that you come up at least to the poverty line or whatever that level is. And this was Nixon's proposal, of all people. It was fashioned by the late senator, well, he wasn't a senator then, Daniel Patrick Moynihan. And it actually passed the House of Representatives and died in the Senate Finance Committee. It came that close to becoming
That's
the law
close.
Of the land.
And in 1797, Thomas Paine, you remind us, declared nations should give every 21-year-old a lump sum. If you don't inherit land, you are at a disadvantage.
Right. So it's been talked about for a long time, but it really came to the Martin Luther King called for a basic income. Milton Friedman, the conservative economist, is the one who came up with the idea of the negative income tax. Nobel Prize-winning economists such as James Tobin and John Kenneth Galbraith supported it. So there was a period when it really was on the, out there as a policy people were talking about, and then it just sort of went underground for several decades. But I do think that with the radicalization of society due to rising economic inequality, it's sort of come back.
Mm-hmm. And Judith, the obvious question next is, how do you pay for it?
Right. That is the obvious question. I mean, the most obvious answer is, if you just simply paid out a basic income, you could get rid of all the anti-poverty programs that exist. Things like the temporary assistance for needy families, which is what replaced, you know, welfare, food stamps, the earned income tax credit. The earned income tax credit, by the way, is the thing most like some sort of family or caregiving benefit that we have, but it is only for those who are employed, of course. The unemployed don't get it. But we would get rid of things like that. And one economic study I read said, you know, simply getting rid of that would free up $500 billion already. We would have to start thinking about what else we would eliminate. We might eliminate middle-class tax exemptions. We might start taxing speculative financial transactions. We might start imposing a carbon tax. Some people have talked about a flat tax, a value-added tax. And to be honest, this universal basic income isn't that universal, because in a certain sense, as you sort of go up the income scale, you would start paying back some of this in taxes. This would not be taxed, but you would start sort of returning it in tax money. So there are a lot of different ideas about how to pay for it, and there's a lot of debate about whether it's actually affordable. There are people who say it is, depending on what we're willing to get rid of.
Well, let's go to phone calls. I think Judith will have many calls on this. So we're talking about the universal basic income and why it's being much discussed now. There is a proposal in Finland to pay every adult $870 a month. In Alaska, we made reference to that because of royalties from oil companies. Everybody's given about $2,000 due to the amount of money that the oil industry is making. It's not $2,000 a month, but the idea is in existence somewhere in this country. The Swiss are going to vote in a referendum on basic income. So it's an idea. And in Canada, also, the ruling Liberal Party is adopting a resolution calling for similar kind of thing in Canada. What do you think about this idea? Every adult getting, you know, fill in the blank, if you think it's a good idea, $1,000 a month, $870 a month. And it would certainly, obviously, help mothers who are tending to their very young children. It would give people more flexibility in the workforce to be at home some portion of the year. People could save for retirement who don't really have incomes now for work that they are doing. How would we pay for such a thing? Is it an idea whose time has come? And what do you think of it? Here's our phone number for you to talk with Judith Shulevitz. She is the author of the piece that was in the New York Times, which will be on our Facebook page if you haven't read it, because it's really well worth reading. It's terribly interesting. It's Payback Time for Women. Society is getting a free ride on our perpetuation of the human race. Judith is also author of The Sabbath World, Glimpses of a Different Order of Time. She's a contributing opinion writer for the New York Times. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is @KDunnShow. And you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls. They are coming in great numbers, as I expected they would. We'll start with Mary in Milwaukee. Hi, Mary.
Hello, I love this idea. I know a lot of people that are on the verge of retiring, but they can't because they can't afford to retire. So this would open a lot of doors for people to do that, so that younger people could come in and take those jobs.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought. Judith?
Well, in fact, that's one of the things that basic income would allow people to do is save toward retirement. If you are unemployed for a long time or you are a stay-at-home parent by choice, then you don't have access to Social Security, IRAs, 401ks, et cetera, and you're just shut out of the work. You're shut out of retirement. I mean, you just have no means to save for your retirement. And of course, we also know that pensions are being cut, commitments are not being honored, and so on. So yes, you know, this would give the elderly, a minimum to live on.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mary, very much for your call. Bill in Madison, hi.
Hello. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I just wanted to comment. Some research that I'm somewhat aware of indicates that people aren't just here to work. I know Judith Shulevitz mentioned in her New York Times article this morning there's some concern about what happens when the machines take over and everyone's just on the dole and so forth and not having to work. And it's not just a matter of raising children either. It's a matter of many of the things that people do to have a rich life, to do art, to do outdoor exploring, things like that. And that's an important thing, I think, to take into consideration. Also relevant to this is the extensive research of Benjamin Honeycutt, a historian at the University of Iowa, who's devoted his whole career to studying, basically, as he told me once, the question of what happens, why haven't we liberated people from work during the 200 years that we've been producing labor-saving devices? So there's a broad body of research there to bring us to this question. He says the real American dream back well into the 20th century was that people would be liberated from work to do what they called the higher values or something like that. People like Walt Whitman, for example, espoused that idea, and it hasn't happened. But what Ms. Shulevitz is talking about would be the make that possible.
Right, right, Judith.
Yes. So I was focused specifically on a kind of work I believe is work but isn't paid for, which is the work of care. It's this really complicated question: is the work of love also the work of care? And any parent who has taken care of an infant knows they're both. It's both. So there are things that are simply necessary to sheer human survival that are both work and love. And then there's, yes, the higher order aspects of existence, which we are wealthy enough to support far better than we do. That is an argument I shied away from, although I don't think one should necessarily shy away from just because that takes you into a whole other realm. But I do think that the argument that we all do this work that makes us a richer society, like the work of volunteering, like, the work women used to do when they were sort of limited to their own neighborhoods, that really held these neighborhoods together, and that the ill effects that we've had of women leaving these neighborhoods, not because women should be the ones who have to do this work of holding neighborhoods together through volunteerism, et cetera, but because, we just didn't solve the problem of, well, what happens next, So that was what I focused on, but I certainly agree with the caller that it would be wonderful if we could distribute the wealth that we have in a fairer way so that more people would have access to these better things of life.
Mm-hmm. And let's explore a little further, because you can hear some criticism coming right now, as it did of welfare in this country. Oh, this is going to make a whole lot of people be very lazy, and people aren't going to want to work, and we'll have a bunch of shiftless Americans.
If you're asking me this question?
Yes.
So that you'd think that would be the case, but there's two arguments against that. The current welfare programs have what is called extremely high marginal tax rates. In other words, if you're on TANF, every dollar you earn gets deducted from what you get. So you have no incentive to go back to work unless you can really make a lot more over than you're currently getting, which is probably not the case. It's going to be, if you're sort of at that rung of society, it's going to be pretty hard for you to jump up to a higher, much higher income. So you are given a disincentive to go back to work. A basic income you just keep, and then anything you earn on top of that, you also keep, or, you pay taxes on, but you also keep. And that actually is more of an incentive to go back to work, since the basic income isn't going to be that much money. So that's one argument. The other argument is that there have been studies of both very poor areas and sort of middle class areas in which people got the basic income, and they discovered that people did not cut back on their working hours all that much. Especially these were in the 70s. The one I'm thinking of of the middle class, they were in Canada and the United States, and so the primary breadwinners in those cases were the men. And the men only cut back as much as 9%. That was the highest level that they cut back in the different experiments. And the what they found is that they weren't like working part-time. They were taking longer between jobs to start new jobs. And the speculation is that they were waiting for better jobs to come along. They weren't desperate and just taking any right. job that came along. Mm-hmm. They were matching their skills to the job market, and they had that leeway, which in the end will actually produce a more productive society.
Thank you so much, Bill, for your call. Ted from Menominee sends this email, Judith. He works for a living, and this idea seems like it's the equivalent of stealing from workers.
Right. So the feminist argument is, so do stay-at-home mothers. They also work, just not for a living. I don't. If anyone has ever stayed home with kids, they know it's extremely demanding labor at every level, physical and emotional, managerial, and, just, as I said, physical. So that's a fundamental injustice in society. So there's, this is a way to funnel money to those who do this unremunerated work. So that's my comeback to that. And another argument is that we would actually, building on what I said before about not scaling back at work but actually becoming more productive, we would become a more productive society. The poor people would actually have incentives to be more productive.
We're talking about a universal basic income this hour of our program. Should we all be receiving, I don't know exactly what it should be, in Finland the proposal is $870 a month. Should we receive that or more, just as the contract that we make between citizens who live in America and our government? It would be helpful to women, and as our guest writes in her recent piece in the New York Times, mothers and other caregivers, for the heavy lifting they do right now free of charge. This isn't just for mothers, it's for everybody. Everybody would be given a universal basic income, which would be expensive. How would we pay for it? Would it open up life, more possibilities in life, and making life a little bit easier for many of us? What do you think of the idea being discussed now in the United States, certainly in Canada and in some Northern European countries? We have one line open if you'd like to join the conversation. Please do so. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. Bart is next. Hi, Bart. Bart, are you there? All right, Bart's not there. Call back. Jean in Ashland. Hi.
Hi. I've heard that the bookkeeping overall, if all the other welfare programs were dropped, that the bookkeeping on a basic income plan would be cheaper, and all the efforts to keep track of who's eligible and who's not eligible for various welfare programs, that would all be dropped, so that wouldn't be the expense anymore.
Right. That's one of the ways in which you would save a lot of money. That's a key part of the argument. You've put your finger right on it. When you have these things called means-tested programs, right, which means you have to qualify, and think of old-fashioned welfare, where this is long gone, thank God, but where you had to be a single mother and there had to be no husband in the house or no male breadwinner in the house, and you had these social workers snooping around to make sure that you weren't violating the terms of welfare. That's sort of the worst image of it all. But there are all kinds of things that people have to do to qualify, and there have to be, extensive investigations. So all of that, and then, ongoing surveillance. So all of that is, in fact, quite expensive. Administering these very complex programs, they're not just complex in terms of qualifying, but just in payouts and all kinds of things. So just getting rid of all that, would produce significant savings in and of itself above the savings that come from just, you know, getting rid of that particular program, the cost of that program.
Would it be detrimental to people embracing the idea if you put an income limit on this, if you make, say, over $150,000 a year, you're not eligible for this, or does it have to be universal?
I believe that politically it's more plausible if it's universal. Everybody gets Social Security who pays into Social Security, whether they're billionaires or, you know, truck drivers. And one of the reasons it's so hard to get rid of Social Security is because everybody views it as an entitlement, as part of their contract with the government. So the argument for a universal basic income is that it becomes general entitlement, and we all take it for granted. It becomes much harder to get rid of. And, of course, it also becomes harder to pass. But it, once it's there, people are not going to want to lose it. And you have buy-in from all classes. And also, again, once you're targeting specific populations, then you're doing means testing. And you have to administer that, and that's expensive.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Jean, so much for your call. Mark is next. Hi, Mark.
Hello.
Hi.
This is something that Buckminster Fuller has brought up, the creator of the geodesic dome. And I've been in the situation of being a single dad, self-employed, and a big volunteer for a bunch of different organizations. So I totally agree that this is something that can actually incentivize creativity and production in a culture.
Yeah, well, so you exemplify the reason why, you know, it shouldn't, for example, go to women, right? Because you're doing all the work that, you know, 50, 75, 100 years ago, we associated exclusively with women, and more men, thank goodness, are doing. And really, what we're talking about is paying for caregiving, which is volunteering, which is taking care of your kids, which is just being a good citizen and contributing to the quality of life in the society you live in. And that is, I think, what the sort of philosophical principle is behind a universal basic income.
Thanks very much for your call. We go next to Randy in Waukesha. Hi, Randy.
Good afternoon. I was just wondering, how are we going to get the employers or people to pay for this? I mean, in my experience throughout my work and life, near impossible for to get employers to pay fair living wages as it is for people that actually produce.
Mm-hmm.
Where do they think we're going to get this money from? And I had another comment, if you might let me get it through. I have a place in northern Wisconsin, and right down the street from me is a very lucrative native gaming casino. And the residents there that are eligible for a monthly stipend, they receive several thousand dollars per month. And it's more than a living wage, and I'll tell you, it hasn't solved any problems up there as far as alcoholism or drugs or anything like that. I just don't know if this is something that will work.
Thanks, Randy, for the call.
Well, the situation on Native American reservations or communities, that's something I've actually never thought about. I think there are probably, you know, there are a lot of other conditions which contribute to the life that is led there. So I just can't comment. It's an interesting problem. One thing to be clear about is it's not employers who would pay for this. It would be the U.S. government, which would be funding it out of taxes. So you're saying, you know, a lot of employers and businesses are not going to want to pay these taxes. And again, there are different ways of structuring these taxes. Maybe it would be a flat tax. Maybe it would be a value-added tax. It would certainly be getting rid of, you know, anti-poverty programs that don't affect employers right now or that they pay into already. I don't pretend to have the answer of how this would be paid for, and I don't pretend to be able to sort of say definitively it's affordable, it's not affordable. I think we do have to say that we as a society have to make the decision that we want to be able to afford it, because we'd probably have to pay more in taxes, although some people make the argument that the amount of taxes that would increase would actually be less than the amount we'd receive back in basic income. I don't have the answer. I'm not an economist. I'm simply saying there's people out there making this argument.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for your call. You talk about people on the right and people on the left supportive of this idea. You mentioned Charles Murray of the American Enterprise Institute, who says, as you say in your piece, a guaranteed income could replace the welfare state. Do you think that's true completely?
I mean, I think that the people on the right want to get rid of more than the people on the left, and you know, that's going to be true, no matter how you look at it. Yes, I mean, he'd like to get rid of Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare, probably the Affordable Care Act, et cetera, et cetera. So more things than I think most people would feel comfortable with. And the argument is similar to the argument made by one of your previous callers, which is, you know, administering these is incredibly complicated and expensive, and there's a lot of waste that goes into them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, you know, Charles Murray goes that far. There's some libertarians who make a really interesting argument, usually thought of as on the right, and they basically say one of the, they have a bunch of different arguments. They like the idea of dismantling the welfare state, but they say, you know, the government has no business prying on the private lives of the poor. So all of the documentation you have to fill out and all of the hurdles you have to jump over to qualify for welfare are degrading and demeaning, and the government should not be in the business of passing judgments on which citizens are worthy and not worthy. So they're saying, and so you think libertarians are anti-tax, of course, but not all are. And some thoughtful libertarians say, look, we're against taxes, but we're going to have taxes, so let's try to come up with the least intrusive taxes we can. And they think basic income, a flat tax plus a basic income is probably the best way to go.
Marcia on Facebook says she's been advocating for this for years, wishing it would gain a foothold. Why do we not do everything in our power to enable a parent, it needn't be a mother, to raise their own children? It makes no sense at all to subsidize institutional daycare but not a stay-at-home parent.
I just couldn't agree more. I completely agree. And that's one of the things, I mean, that's some of the pushback I've been getting, which is that, well, it's ridiculous to you know, just send it out as basic income. We should target it. And since it's so hard to target, you know, caregivers because their lives are complicated, et cetera, let's just pay for public daycare the way that, for example, they do in France. And my comeback to that is not every parent wants to contract out, you know, child rearing. And it seems a little goofy to force people to, you know, give their children into the, I'm not saying some people don't, and I'm not saying that if you want to be a two-parent working family, daycare wouldn't help you out a lot. I'm all for subsidized daycare, but, it shouldn't be required. It should be acknowledged that there is honor, dignity, and value being created by parents who raise their own children.
We're talking about the universal basic income this hour of our show, and our guest is Judith Shulevitz. She is an opinion writer for the New York Times, has a piece that's on the front page of the Sunday Review section, which we're putting on our Facebook page if you haven't read it. It's really a phenomenally interesting article that has a historical look at this and what's happening with universal basic income in Canada and in Northern European countries. Her piece is titled, It's Payback Time for Women. Society is getting a free ride on our perpetuation of the human race. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter, at K Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go back to phone calls, and our next caller is Sean in Madison. Hi, Sean.
Hi there. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good, thanks. I have really enjoyed, I came in midstream and really like what is being talked about here. You know, I'm pretty unabashedly a socialist. My concern with if we did a universal income across the board without some other basic changes, and you know, including regulation and kind of reining in free market, that basically would end up being a handout to corporations, because all the costs of everything is just going to go up and offset that, and it's all going to end up being more profits for corporate America. So, just wondering what the guest would.
So you're saying it would just create inflation?
Exactly. Yeah.
So that is an interesting question to which I do not know the answer, although the economists I've read, without my having drilled down on it very thoroughly, do not think that that is the case. What they think would be the case is that, you know, the poor tend to spend more of their income than the rich. The rich sit on their income. They invest it. The poor spend it on basic goods. So if you give money to the poor, if you redistribute money to the poor, they actually will, in fact, revive, give a boost to the economy, which is sort of what you're saying. But I guess I see that as a good thing, right, because that's going to create more jobs, et cetera. You know, the National Recovery Act, you know, Roosevelt's policies during the Great Depression was to get money into the hands of the people who were out of work and desperately poor, so as to get industry going again. And that's what, you know, of course, World War II did. So getting money to people who don't have it now, or who have too little of it now, I just think probably would be good for the economy. I don't think it would create inflation, but I'm not an economist, and I can't exactly explain why that's the case.
Hmm. Okay.
Thanks.
All right, thanks.
Thanks, Sean. Joan in Eau Claire, hi.
Good afternoon. Fascinating program. I found the earlier caller's comment very interesting, and this was a comment, why have we not relieved Americans of work with all of the innovations in technology and robotics? That's very idealistic, and it sounds great. However, it's my comment that the very wealthy will fight tooth and nail and buy politicians for that never to happen. In my opinion, the wealthy business owners, such as perhaps the Kochs and the Waltons, are perfectly happy with American workers being enslaved to them, and that includes a very large Wisconsin employer. These people are against, they're fighting against the social programs that we have now, such as Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare. And that's my comment, and thank you for allowing me to speak.
Thanks, Jim. Judith?
You never know what can change till you try to change things. Things. It's really remarkable how quickly things change. If you look at American history, the change from Herbert Hoover to Franklin Roosevelt was extraordinary, and we created an entirely different kind of nation. It looks pretty bleak. But on the other hand, there are a lot of very radical candidates and ideas that are being talked about that were unimaginable
yes.
a decade ago. So
that's true.
I just think you can't lose hope.
Mm-hmm. Social Security, what a radical idea that must have been, huh?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. All right, let's read a couple messages that have come in. Debbie says, we can't even get equal pay for women doing equal work. How would we ever get this through? And Julie says, I've advocated for women receiving 20 to 30% more in Social Security, as women have been historically paid 70 cents on every dollar that a male earns. Of course, the men that I've proposed this to have said that doesn't make any sense. I think this approach would work better, as it would include everyone.
So equal pay for equal work, the pay gap, the wage gap, actually is really a motherhood gap. So the pay levels between single women and men tend to be pretty equal. In other words, there's not a big difference between women before they have children and sort of their peers. Their male peers. Where the gap happens is when women have children. They start working second shifts. They start. You know, there's sheer discrimination against, you know, mothers because it's thought they can't do the same amount of work as everyone else. And there's also the reality that they can't do the same amount of work as everyone else because they're doing twice as much, and they go part time. They drop out. And overall, the amount that women get paid is dragged down by the pay cuts that mothers take to be when they become mothers. So that really accounts for not all of that, you know, 30 cents on the dollar, but a really big chunk of it. So I would argue we're not going to get equal pay for equal work unless we find a way to value the work women are already doing for free.
Thanks very much for your call. Let's go to Stella in Sturgeon Bay. Hi, Stella.
Hi. I would really just like to bring up the point and make it very clear that caring, all of your comments seem to be addressed to motherhood. Those of us adult children who care for a frail or a demented parent, which we did for my mother and my mother-in-law. My mother had dementia for the last 62 months of her life. We cared for her, and caring for, without any kind of compensation, we cared for her in our home. So we saved the state a whole lot of money for not having her in a nursing home. And caring for a demented adult has all of the same responsibilities, the stresses, the demands, the requirements of caring for a newborn in an adult body, which magnifies the load.
Yes,
so please, let's keep our eyes and hearts open here for the terrors of adults.
Well, amen to that, and you're absolutely right. I couldn't agree more, and it's going to only become a bigger problem as, you know, the baby boom generation, which is the demographic bulge in our society, is retiring at a rate of, I think, 10,000 people a day.
Whoa!
And it's going to become a huge problem, and that's why some of the organizations I know who work on supporting caregivers are really focusing on elder care rather than child care, because that's the pressing issue. And I would even say, you know, the caller said it's just as stressful as caring for a newborn. I would guess it's a whole lot more.
Mm-hmm.
Dealing with dementia is, you know, a lot harder than dealing with a newborn.
Yeah. Thank you, Stella. And Laura says something similar. She would have been able to take care of her parents with this system rather than placing them in nursing home care. She couldn't forfeit her job. She had to plan for her own senior years. Their nursing home care for the two of them was over $6,000 a month. It took all they'd saved over their lifetime, and that was 10 years ago. She says, I can't begin to imagine what it would be today.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you, Stella, very much for your call. Jerry in Lake Mills. Hi.
Hi. I have said for a long time that women have made churches, countries, corporations filthy rich on their low-paid and non-paid contributions to these organizations. It's about time we have payback time. And besides, I graduated over 50 years ago from high school, and we have barely gained a little over 20 cents in comparison to men's wages. At this rate, it'll be another 75 or 100 years before we're on par with the men's wages. And the largest segment of our population are in poverty are elderly women, because they don't make enough to save for their retirement, and then they're left in absolute poverty.
Judith.
You know, I agree. I mean, what am I supposed to say? I completely agree. As I said, we are not going to, in fact, get rid of the pay gap until we find a way to pay for the work that women are doing, whether it's elder care or child care. I mean, I do think elder care is more gender equal. I mean, I think studies show that women do more of it because they are the ones who are expected to be the caregivers in our society even now. But I do think that, you know, more men take care of their elderly parents than take care of little children. And that's a way of seeing why this should not be a gendered thing. It should just be a caregiver thing.
Thank you so much for your call. Judith, I'll bet your newspapers received a huge response to this article.
I don't know, but I hope so.
I'll bet they have, just judging on the kind of response we're getting here. Thank you very much for being with us and for writing this. We call ourselves the Ideas Network, and I love it when ideas like this that really resonate with so many people in favor and not in favor of it resonate with the audience. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Our guest, Judith Shilovitz, and her piece is on our Facebook page in case you missed it in Sunday's New York Times, The Universal Basic Income. Talk about it beginning to surface here in the United States. Finnish government has proposed every adult, $870 a month. Also, Canada's new party recently adopted a resolution for a similar experiment. There's an experiment in the Dutch city of Utrecht, and the Swiss will be voting on this year. It's interesting, isn't it? We thanks Judith for being with us. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this hour. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for on-air production. The history of Washington, D.C., it is fascinating. The author of a new book on this will be joining us, and I hope you'll stay tuned. You're going to learn so much. That's fascinating after the news.